You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Welcome to Tuesday Home Time with Joan Bartlett. 2 hours of current affairs, followed by lawyers from the Federation of Community Legal Centres with their program Done by Law. For the past hour, you've been listening to Anne McAllister with her Celtic Folk Show. And a reminder, there are many ways you can access 3CR programs. The old analogue radio, 8:55 AM, they're still around and still okay. And you can do digital, which the call sign is 3CR. Or go online, either streaming for a week, any program on 3CR, and the podcast, which is posted for this program in the next couple of days. And you can access those last two avenues through the webpage of 3CR, which is 3cr.org.au, and follow the prompts. And happy listening. Today, a guest in Melbourne last week was Elmer Labog, a longtime leader of the KMU Labor Centre in the Philippines, and he was in Australia for a week. He's been the chairperson of the KMU, the May 1st Labor Movement, for over 20 years and just stood aside to become the Emeritus Chair at the 13th KMU Congress, which was held in June between the 28th and the 29th. He discusses a great deal of more general terms with the trade union movement, the situation for workers in the Philippines, which is one marked by very low wages and high levels of repression, as well as the more general political situation there, at present marked by high tensions between the Ferdinand Marcos Jr. president and the Duterte family with Sarah. He's also very concerned about the military tensions between the US and China and how they affect the Philippines. Dr. Binoy Campmark from RMIT University will be speaking about the Western leaders and their words rather than actions for the Palestinian people holding on to their lives as Israel continues its genocidal actions in the Gaza Strip and now also in the West Bank. And the final part of the webinar focus, analysing the impact of the Zionist lobby on Australian media and politics, featuring Palestinian activist Amin Alabada, journalist Wendy Bacon, and Yaakov Haran. But first, it's him, it's Mr. Kevin Healy, and he's had another one of those weeks.
A week, Jane, listener, when in the water, water everywhere, but not a drop to drink department. Congratulations to the Minister for Pollution, Murray Swatch, the Environment, for providing $14 million to assist those affected by South Tribulawassee's disastrous algal bloom. Probably it would have been smarter to have done something about it months ago, as the bloom was at its embryonic stage, when scientists pleaded with Murray to take action. And Murray, with understandably deep concern, explained, it was none of his business, none of his blooming business. Getting in early to prevent an environmental disaster is none of the business of the minister, let's give him his official title, Minister for the Environment. Then, Murray, what is your business? Oh, of course, approving gas, gas, gas until 2070 so we can transition from gas, gas, gas and assuring us Woodside with profits, profits will cause no damage whatever to 50,000 years of Indigenous art. And Murray also asserts the environmental disaster, the worst marine disaster we've known according to marine scientists, is not a national disaster, leaving us to ponder what level of damage of disaster might qualify. No worries here in Victoria either, as we saw ducks swimming in water that had turned blue. Who knows what exists below the surface? The big build constructing lane upon lane upon lane upon lane of exhaust pipe and plastic pollution at the North East Link, believed responsible, but good news. The government assured us the pollution poses no health threat whatever. It is totally safe, it guaranteed. Thank goodness. So what is the chemical? We don't know. The minister don't know. Phew, thank goodness. Totally safe, unknown chemical pollution. The scientists who pleaded unsuccessfully with Murray months ago suggest climate change, if there is such a thing, may have a bit to do with the algae, like roughly 100% give or take. And as the heavens flood Texas, one of the big fossil polluters, a fossil, not that it's an orphan in that department, but taken by this headline in the Spencer Street, no longer Spencer Street, Fairfax the other day, Texans search heaven and earth for flood answers. We're not sure they need to look that far. Still, climate change, if there is, has its positives, like as the Arctic melts, the fossils have access to more fossils, more riches, like great fossil behemoth Conoco flips the blame, delighting US of the UN, of the US of the world, big supremo Donald Trump or the poor, he of drill, baby, drill. Conoco flips the blame, applying to extend its oil drilling in Alaska, the potential for hundreds of millions of barrels. It's so clever, isn't it? Climate change, if there is, caused by the great corporates like ConocoPhillips, thaws the poles and allows them to contribute even more to the transition from themselves. With the usual suspects like long-haired, greeny, commie, wooden worker and iron environmentalists carrying on about the bit of pollution all this would cause, and Native Americans claiming it will damage their country. No concern whatever for what the ConocoPhillips shareholders want and need. Whatever happened to good old-fashioned take and take? Not that there's any problems. With Donald at the helm, the right decision will be made. On the important need for more fossils so we can transition from more fossils, the aforementioned Woodside with profits continues to take its responsibility seriously. This week, our old mate Supremo Meg O'Neill before profits announcing proudly that this new global fossil acquisitions Woodside with is achieving its ambition of being one of the world's great fossils, showing its unswerving dedication to the transition. Meg keeps reminding us all this fossils, gas is all about. Albeit obviously a slow process, as the permit to coexist with 50,000 years of rock art until 2070 attests. And we know they can coexist because Murray and Western Troubler Wazzy Supremo Roger Cook the Planet told us they can coexist. Challenged by the local Terra Nullius non-land, non-people, this Save Our Songlines mob who claim all that gas will destroy their sacred sites. Based on nothing more than years of gas already causing irreparable damage. But if it comes to Murray and Roger and Meg, all these non-land, non-people, we know who to believe. As a by the by on these matters, the Political Maturity of the Week award must go to that appalling Hoonson and her no-notion lot for turning their backs on an acknowledgement of country as the Talkfest opened. Don't they know it's just token and won't lead to anything as damaging or dangerous as policy? After a mere 21 months of defending Zion's right to defend itself against an occupied people who, by inference, under that definition, have no right to oppose being occupied and terrorised, no right to defend themselves, our courageous government joined lots of other countries in suggesting maybe the defend itself was going a bit far. Don't slaughter, destruct, genocide, starve quite as much. And then thousands of people sign a petition suggesting words without action aren't enough. Ban contact, sanction the real terrorists, words and action. Would that stop us sending weapons parts to Zion? The minister for being offensive and train-killing Richard Moore's the bad guys. He of the giant mind looked very concerned on behalf of the socialists. You mean the weapons you deny we send? Exactly. Can we still supply the weapons we deny we send? Well, no. Shame on you. Shame on you for supporting a blatantly anti-Semitic petition. Watching the footy Thursday night, Carlton being thrashed yet again, interspersed with those ads we get after every goal, that contributed to public-private health boo-poor dears, informing us it is a proud sponsor of the Carlton Football Club. And I thought, how appropriate. The team getting its weekly thrashing and good old boo-poor dears, perhaps they should be blue paw deers. Anyway, Blue Paw recently fined millions for taking the money but refusing to provide the service, and now being hit for cutting staff and making shift changes at its aged care facilities, the nurses' union claiming not only problems for workers but also a threat to the quality of service. So I thought Carlton and Blue Paw do make a fine team. On the great corporates, ANZ for Service Bank is being investigated by the Trubliwazi Securities and Investments Commission over a little matter of alleged bond market manipulation. The investigation being dragged out because ANZ4 keeps complaining about interviews with members of its key markets team being too aggressive. Oh dear, why can't the investigators just take no for an answer? They must know how sensitive good, respectable bankers are. And it came to light the tax department, so vigilant and relentless, waived a $1 million tax bill owed by former Big Supremo and the world's greatest worst ex-treasurer, Paul, a true socialist, as the revelation revealed a heap of corporates and cross-corporates owned by Paul. That's why, as a true socialist, he so empathises with the poorest of the poor, who are nonetheless facing a cornucopia of riches, as current Big Supremo Anthony Albanese said, although his salary is 600 plus grand, and after 30 years with his bum on the plush seat, I know I get a good salary, but I know what struggle is. I know what it's like to struggle. See, empathy. And given in that moment of elation on election night he guaranteed no one will be left behind, then the poorest of the poor, like the unemployed, can expect the cornucopia to start flowing any time soon. Coal behemoth Adani bloody environmentalist has avoided the little problem of having a huge tax bill waived. Just don't pay any in the first place. See, despite its huge fossil mine, which did cause a bit of protest, and its subsidiary carrying the pollution to its port, the train, another subsidiary, the port, they're all losing millions year after year, so much as it would just love to pay tax on all that pollution, it just can't. How come a profitable polluter is losing so much, I hear? Well, see, it owes millions each year, coincidentally, roughly what the mine earns, to debtors in low-tax places, loans and interest and lease payments, debtors who, what do we know, just happen to be also subsidiaries of the Adani bloody conglomerate. But I hope no one would think for a second this might be a tax dodge. And Alcoa, the transnational aluminium power guzzler, with massive worldwide profits, Canadian business provides aluminium for the US of, but profits have taken a dive thanks to Donald's tariffs. So what's the answer? The Canadian government, Alcoa says, must come to the rescue. See, governments do have a role to play in the laissez-faire, dog-eat-dog world of the greatest little economic order of them all. In the gee, who could have seen that coming department, our state socialists introduced a tax on empty homes, hoping to help solve the housing crisis, as they call it. But figures show thousands of developers and investors are avoiding the tax because of one little problem the government obviously overlooked, like, how do you know? Anyway, the Property Profits Council said the tax prevents developers and investors solving the housing crisis, which is, of course, uppermost on their minds. Finally, notice Donald's latest medical examination shows he has a vein problem. Surely we didn't need a medical test to tell us that. Good afternoon.
And many thanks to Mr. Kevin Healy for his week that was. And he'll be back on air here at 3CR tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. with the team from City Limits.
The Melbourne Documentary Film Festival returns to Cinema Nova this July for Past, Present, Future. Beginning on July 15, warm up the cold winter days with a revitalising collection of local and international documentaries from independent and emerging talents. Melbourne Documentary Film Festival, a jewel in Melbourne's cultural crown. Screening from July the 15th for a limited time at Cinema Nova. 380 Lygon Street, Carlton. Cinema Nova is a 3CR supporter.
I'm speaking now with a man who is at the forefront of struggle for trade union and human rights in the Philippines, Elmer Labo. He's a lifetime leader of the KMU Labor Center in the Philippines. Chairperson of the KMU, May 1st Labor Movement, for over 20 years, and in the past month was the Emeritus Chair at the 13th KMU Conference held in the last days of June 2025. Elmer was in Australia last week with meetings in Sydney, Canberra, Melbourne and Perth. I spoke with him when he was in Melbourne last Friday, and my first question to him was regarding the KMU, the 1st of May Labor Movement. What was its set up and what is its role been in the labor movement in the Philippines?
Well, the KMU is a labor center composed of nine federations, mainly line industries and general unions. It has nine national federations under it, and it has 16 regional organizations. That means that all the we call local, which is equivalent to a company, can galvanize together in a given region. For example, if you are in Mindanao, so there's going to be a conglomeration of all the local unions, either with KMU or those that are independent in nature.
And how do you work within the society? I'd imagine that there are quite repressive laws in the Philippines concerning the working class. How do you operate? With what safety do you operate?
Well, we are a registered entity with the Department of Labor, and that we are a part of the International Trade Union Confederation, one of the four affiliates in the Philippines, and that we regularly represent our trade union center, just like the Australian Council of Trade Unions at the ILO. So we operate not just in Metro Manila, but we are both operating nationally and internationally.
Now, Philippines is a big country because a lot of islands, small islands and bigger islands. What are the main issues for the workers, both rural and urban?
Well, poverty begets not just the workers, but this is a condition that impacts on all of the majority of the Filipino people. This is because of the backward agricultural development that it has till now, since it's liberty from the so-called liberty from the Americans. And this brings us to a situation where we have a very big number of workers that leaves the country in a day, like 6,000, because of the inavailability of jobs and better wages. That explains why this has been a continuous exodus of people, as we couldn't develop our own industries, like the mining companies would tend to export the mineral resources that's been extracted from different regions, so in so many years, but then doesn't go back to us as processed products, and so we do not have a lot of work being generated from the mineral resources that had been extracted for many generations already in my country. And so this backwardness has been there since our inception as a republic. But then again, this has been aggravated currently with the imposition of a 20% tax by the U.S. through Donald Trump, Marcos Jr. was bragging about his negotiations with the U.S., which resulted to just 1% deduction, and he calls this a great achievement, and it's a really shameful achievement to say the least.
How do you believe that 20% will affect the working people of the Philippines?
Well, you know, we are basically an agricultural country, and most of our imports are from the agri sector. That's the most populated sector in terms of workers' employment, as the population are mostly from the agri sector. And so even before the actual imposition of a 19% tax on exportable goods to the U.S., the employers group have already warned that they cannot, avoid firing of workers from various industries that would be affected by our export products. And so we are actually anticipating the great impact of this new imposed restrictions on our export, a small export area in the Philippines. So we're bracing ourselves on the upcoming implementation of such a lopsided policy, as the Philippines export would have a 19% tax, whereas on the other hand, against a very big economy, zero tariff. And so you could see the imbalance existing on both parties, and this is very detrimental to the conditions prevailing now in my country. Thus, this will more or less agitate more exodus of workers to other countries to find better working conditions, better wages, and better lives for that matter.
That's the thing with the people of the Philippines. There are so many living overseas, many of them women, maybe most of them women, having to leave their own country, having to leave their families, their children, for their other members of their family to raise, because they cannot afford to live and raise their families in the Philippines.
Yes, that's one of the sacrifices that the migrant Filipinos are having now, emotionally and really like leaving families behind. As I was saying, the best condition is for Filipinos to be with their families, both immediate and relatives, as well as friends. That would really help in stabilizing the emotional conditions of every worker. But then this is one of the high risk and the emotional anguish that migrant Filipinos suffer by staying abroad. But then it's a means to keep their families alive. It's a matter of sacrificing themselves. So I don't necessarily agree with. And they are constrained to leave the country. As I was saying, there is a widespread unavailability of decent jobs, decent wages, and other basic necessities that should be provided for us as workers, as well as Filipino citizens. So this is not being met by the present dispensation, and thus this proves why there are about 6,000 Filipinos which leave the country every day.
Can you talk about the environmental impacts on the Philippines? I'm thinking first about the mines, the huge mines that there are in the Philippines, and the environmental impacts of those. But we hear yearly about the typhoons or floods, volcanoes that devastate large sections of the Philippines. What is the problem with those typhoons?
Well, I guess the very basic things that affects the environment, especially the massive destruction, flooding and earthquakes that are happening now. Like we just had a 3-day continuous rainfall in the Philippines, and this caused a lot of destructions in the community, especially those who are close to the mountains and countryside. This is because of the rampant violation of the forestry laws. Like we don't have enough forest cover, and the forests are usually denuded, and so it couldn't control the floodwaters coming from the mountains. And this reaches the catch basins, I mean the dams, which are the usual sources of water supply, drinking water in Metro Manila. But they have to, you know, release the gates of these dams, and those thus this automatically floods the lower areas of various regions in the Philippines. And so, like just recently, there was a continuous flooding of Metro Manila for 3 to 4 consecutive days. And on the fourth day, here comes another typhoon, which has battered a lot of areas in the Philippines. And so if you ask what's the main cause of this massive destruction that are happening in my country now, it's the you know, unabated cutting of trees just to earn profits by big business, and thus leaving many people in a very desperate situation. So we are fighting against these abuses of the environment, and this impacts primarily to workers, for example, in the forestry and agriculture, but then it also impacts further on the new phenomena of platform workers, where when it rains, it's a problem of flooding. When it's sun, and it's a problem of overheating, and it's both devastating to the health conditions as well as economic situation of workers in many sectors of our society.
How much damage to the mining projects do to the environment to increase the damage that's already there?
Well, even before Duterte came out with the imposed policy of declaring all mineable lands in the Philippines in 2023 open to all mining companies, this has already been a very big problem for us, because it has caused the erosion, loosening up of the soil, and this has devastated a lot of our regions in the Philippines, especially in mining regions like in Mindanao, the Caraga region, and also in the northern part of the Philippines. So the declaration of Duterte of all mineable lands in the Philippines in 2023 had caused severe destructions to the community. And quite surely, the mining company said that contributed a lot to these damages. Especially, it's no longer needed to dig down deep into the mines to extract the minerals that are embedded in there. But then they cut across open pit mining has been more flagrant when Duterte declared this policy of the possibility of mining every possible areas in the Philippines. So while the big mining companies are feasting on the extraction of gold, copper, silver, other available minerals resources in the Philippines, we with a small return of income, the equivalent of this small income for mine workers as well as community dwellers have been really devastating, compared thus to outpaces the positive aspect of the mining communities compared to the supposed gains that we should have from them.
And what happens to the communities who are displaced by these mines?
Well, you know, the mining companies, as a condition of their stay and operations in a given community, would promise free schools, promise, you know, water and other basic necessities. But then this is far from ideal, as it's not really on the very ideal level of assistance that these things are happening. So it's a paltry sum that's being given away by mining companies. This is nil compared to the massive devastation and destruction it does to the community. And so at first, people would be happy, but then in the end, as many years of mining is being done, then people more now feel more and more the impacts of the long mining years in their communities. And this has been demonstrated, for example, in the case of the Oceana Gold Corporation in the northern part of the Philippines, where the community really blocked the continuous operation of the mines, as it clearly impacts on the environment and affects the watersheds. It affects the, you know, the safety, health and safety of the community. And so there was a very strong protest. In fact, we have with a dilemma how to handle liking of workers to work while the community wouldn't want the mines to operate. So we have to balance our position with regard to the willingness of workers to continue their work while the community wanted to stop operation of the mining corporation at Oceana Gold. But then it was during Duterte again where they brought in the police, no? From faraway cities, not in the local communities, but they imported the police force from other cities to disperse the community, and thus the company had continued operation as of the moment.
Can you talk about what you said before, the so-called liberation from the Americans? How has that impact on the everyday life in the Philippines with the Americans?
Well, obviously, the previous government, and especially currently under Marcos Jr., lackeys of the U.S., has firmly say that we don't have our own independent policy. For example, in foreign relation, it's the U.S. that dictates how we should behave in terms of foreign relations. And what's happening now is the possibility and the specter of war is becoming much clearer, especially with the expansion of four more additional U.S. bases in the Philippines. And one of the major issues now is the intention of the U.S. government to open up a weapons depot in the former U.S. Naval base, Subic, in the Philippines. And so this has been a subject of protest now, as both the U.S. and the Philippine governments are happy to promote this intention. This brings us closer to the brink of war, as the already existing bases would have missiles pointed to China, as they gang up on China as a security threat in both the Indian Ocean and Pacific Ocean. And so the dangers of war is quite, the possibilities much closer, as the Philippine government kowtows to the foreign relations and other impositions of the Philippines. And so you will clearly see that even in the aspect of economic activity, that whatever the U.S. says, the Philippine government follows, as demonstrated recently by the imposition of a tax policy against Philippine exports. And this hasn't raised any opposition from any of the government officers at the current time. So practically our socio-economic lives are being dictated upon by the U.S. That's why I say the freedom that we were supposed to have gained in 1946 from the U.S., it's not really a real and genuine freedom, as we do not have the liberty to create our own lives and direction as a free and independent nation.
You're now in the second year of the government of Ferdinand Marcos Jr., which followed on from the disastrous Duterte years. Is there really any difference between these two regimes once they get into power in the Philippines?
Essentially, they are the same, as they would impose the same economic and political policies that had been existing for so long, and the same neoliberal policies of deregulation, privatization, and deregulation exists since then and now. Also, the security conditions are very much the same, like the existence of the attack dog of Duterte, which is known as the National Task Force to End Local Communist Groups, or the NTFLCAC, has been adopted, no, carried over to the Marcos regime. Whilst the number of killings may have reduced, but then one death is means too many. So it has been a continuous thing that there are killings and kidnappings are still prevailing under Marcos, which was also, which things were likewise existent during that time of Duterte. So we still have a lot of political detainees languishing in jail. I'd say languishing because most of them would be there for 7 or more years, and the hearings are very sparse. These are the very inhuman conditions that had existed during Duterte and still are existing now under Marcos.
Are you, though, seeing a new level of problems between the two ruling families, the Dutertes and the Marcos, with the impeachment trial of Duterte's daughter, Sarah? Is that causing a great deal of interest in the Philippines?
Yes, it's a big unfolding drama. And I was saying that in June 7, there was the breakup of Elon Musk and Trump. They were best friends, but then they're just secondhand copycats, as the original drama King and Queens were Marcos and Sarah when they were unity teams. Now they are disunited. So they are the original drama of this friendship and breakup. Indeed, coming impeachment will further heighten the intramurals between the two big families, as this is a big preparation coming up for the 2028 presidential elections, where Sara is still a major candidate for the presidency, and the Marcos family wouldn't want this, as they would want to stay in power, and will surely fill the whoever would be their presidential candidate for 2028. And so I believe that the contradiction will further intensify as the drama unfolds, with primarily with the impeachment team being prepared for. Especially, I've learned that this coming August 4, there's going to be an initial hearing related to the impeachment case of Sara at the Philippine Senate.
Just finally and briefly, Elmer, you're in Australia, where our governments, one after the other, seem to report what's happening in the Philippines. We have Australian soldiers operating in the Philippines. What do you hope to achieve from a visit to Australia?
For me, it is important to call on the Australian citizens to discern what is really taking place in my country now. I know that the Philippine National Police is undergoing its training from the Australian authorities, particularly the police training. But then this very force that's been trained by the courtesy of the Australian governments are the very attack dogs against the workers and ordinary people in the Philippines. And so I call on the Australian people to really condemn what is ongoing, the ongoing attacks against the very people, and to call on the government of Australia to stop funding such activities that betrays the real intention of governments, not really to serve the people, but then to keep them at bay in order for governments to do their own thing, contrary to the likes and wishes of the Filipino people. I think it is important that the Australian people would really see that there are no genuine changes in terms of the economic condition and socio-economic condition, as well as the security conditions of people in the Philippines. So this is, I think, a very important message that should be taken up with our friends in Australia, especially the Australian public in general.
Thank you so much, Elmer, and best wishes for your stay here in Australia.
Thank you very much, too, for giving me this great opportunity to air our specific situation now prevailing in the Philippines. And I wish to thank the many friends who have been with me in my visit to many states in Australia, and hopefully we could continue this genuine friendship and our dream of attaining a real decent and pro-people society. Thank you very much, Jane.
Thank you. I've been speaking with Elmer Labang, the long-term leader of the KMU May 1st Labor Movement in the Philippines. And as I mentioned in that interview, it was recorded on Friday when he was in Melbourne. Over the weekend, the news that the Supreme Court of the Philippines has ruled that the impeachment case against Philippines Vice President Sara Duterte is unconstitutional, even though the court was not absolving Duterte on the charges of missing public funds, amassing unreal wealth, and threatening to kill Philippines President Marcos Jr., the First Lady, and House Speaker. I'm sure there'll be more to come.
As the Taco Helm apocalypse approaches us with impending doom, it's time for the best alternative comedy debate in NAM.
Join us for the 21st annual Green Left Comedy Debate, where progressive comedians will debate whether or not billionaires should run the government.
Featuring your famous, award-winning comedian Tom Ballard as our MC, with the brilliant talents of Nikki Barry, Hellchild, Shirley Hood, Rose Callahan, Sarah Bartolo, and David Fowles.
It will be happening at Saturday, August 9th at the Brunswick Town Hall, with dinner and doors open at 6:30 p.m. with the show beginning at 8 p.m.
There'll be food, drinks and laughter, and special guest President Donald Dump leading the positive team. Take it away, Don.
It's going to be a big debate, a great debate, a beautiful debate. I thought of it, by the way.
And all proceeds to the event will go towards activist media Green Left. So come along and join us on Saturday, August the 9th at the Brunswick Town Hall. And book your tickets by going onto the Green Left website or visiting greenleft.org/events. Green Left is a 3CR supporter.
Help 3CR raise funds by donating your containers. Every eligible drink container that you return to a container deposit scheme recycling point earns 10 cents, which can really add up. 3CR is a donation partner for Victoria's Container Deposit Scheme. The scheme allows you to recycle selected aluminium, glass, or plastic containers and donate the funds earned to a not-for-profit organisation of your choice. Help us raise funds for the station. Search for Community Radio and choose 3CR next time you cash in your cans. Go to cdsvic.org.au for more information.
At the weekend, some of the world leaders dug down under many layers and found that they had a conscience. After 21 months of bombings, tanks, soldiers, all armed with the latest killing machines, poignant Palestinians living or more likely existing in Gaza in an ever precarious situation. Macron in France chose to talk about the possibility of a Palestinian state. Starmer in Britain, under pressure from MPs, is thinking about a Palestinian state, but not immediately. But did concede indefensible starvation of Palestinians in Gaza, called for emergency talks, using the stringent language yet in condemning the actions of Netanyahu. And here in Australia, Albanese, quote, Israel has quite clearly breached international law during the war in Gaza, unquote. And while he supports a two-state solution, his country does not plan for, quote, immediate, unquote, recognition of Palestine. Also at the weekend, I spoke with Dr. Binoy Campmark, senior lecturer at RMIT University, here in Melbourne. Again, Binoy, talk again, writing letters, but no proper action to stop the slaughter.
Well, yes, and this is precisely right. The number of statements now being issued seem to be increasing in number and with frequency, in terms of, for example, the July 21st statement, which featured 28 signatories, including the EU Commissioner for Equality, Preparedness and Crisis Management. It also featured Australia as well. And in that particular statement, it demanded that the war in Gaza end immediately, and that also condemning the Israeli government's model of aid delivery as dangerous, fueling instability and depriving the Gazans of dignity and so on. So the statement is made, and then what happens? Continued military assistance, continued support of Israel in many other theatres, the refusal to actually engage in any concrete way to address this particular problem. So everything is being done bar the fundamental aspect of trying to halt the military machine currently engaging in the conduct it is in Gaza.
What would you like to see happen?
The issues of what used to be seen and frowned upon as, you know, the divestment, the boycott movement and so on, some of these things are starting to look ever more increasingly plausible insofar as the Israeli economy, the Israeli system, Israeli society has to be isolated further and further. Because what's happening at the moment is that there is an increasing almost sense of impunity on the part of the officials engaging in the actions. The proposal, for example, of the humanitarian city by the defense minister, you know, Israel Katz, for example, is extraordinary, because what is essentially that will do, and this is, by the way, also being acknowledged by Israeli commentators, you know, such as the former Israeli Prime Minister Olmert, he's also said that this is essentially would be the creation of a concentration camp. And other statements being made by former, you know, heads of the Israeli military staff and so on have also more or less said the same thing. So in reality, fundamental actions have to be taken on the ground that bite, that actually have an effect, that actually isolate Israel, because in many instances, that's simply not happening. There are a lot of these piecemeal gestures and comments made and so on, and you know, simulated outrage, but without actual substantive progress on anything.
Well, look at the Australian government. They keep on saying, well, you know, there's not much we can do it. We're only a small power on the other side of the globe. But that's not true at all, is it?
No, it's not true at all, because the Australian, and this is where comments like that are so disingenuous, or the position is, because the Australian military, for example, has a very close working relationship with the IDF, with the Israeli Defense Forces. It has contracts. It actually has contracts with several Israeli defense firms and so on. So it is very connected in terms of what it does. And even though, you know, what we can get distracted about the minutiae of detail as to what exactly, for example, is Australia doing in exporting material to Israel and so on, the reality is that Israeli defense firms have ongoing agreements with the Australian military complex. So it is a tangible ongoing thing. And these are the sorts of things that can be addressed. And there's no reason why it can't be done so in a very conspicuous way. But it's very clear that either the government is running scared about the implications of this, given the fact that even though the Israel lobby in Australia is not as potent as, for example, it is in Washington, it's still very much there. So you sort of do wonder whether, you know, that is the sort of thing that does actually end up having bearing on the situation.
Well, while Australia might be making excuses why they can't do things, you've got the small country of Yemen trying to stop the shipping going to Israel. They're still having a go.
Well, yes, it's just an indication that you know, action can be taken, and you know, this thing can be placed into spotlight in terms, in the case of the Houthis in Yemen. Of course, it's a case of at least the policy is just trying to restrict, you know, Israeli shipping, or trying to target you know, Israeli shipping in the context of its movement through the Red Sea and all that. But an indication that the Western powers, largely speaking, and so to speak, are very happy to offer these kind of gestures. And also, for example, just to refer back to that statement I mentioned before from July 21st, you know, there's always this sense of, well, what might be the next step? What might you actually do? Sanctions are never mentioned. Some measure will be taken. For example, the latest hobby horse being pursued here by President Emmanuel Macron in the context of the Palestinian situation is to recognize a Palestinian state. So, but the reality is, of course, fine to issue a statement of recognition of the Palestinian state to join others, but it doesn't actually address the situation immediately on the ground, you know, because it's very clear that Israeli policy is to make the idea of a Palestinian state totally unfeasible, totally stillborn as an idea. So it seems that ideas are being entertained, but without actual sense of dealing with the fundamental problems at hand.
And then we still have politicians and others espousing the two-state solution. Well, it's a bit like what happened in South Africa with the bantustans everywhere. You can't have a state where people are separated.
Yes, it's a nonsense term. The two-state solution as it is now is almost you know, absurdly obsolete as a concept, because the only idea of a two-state solution would be the assumption that the Palestinians would have a viable sovereign entity. And this is not going to happen in the context of what Israel's doing. The whole point of Israel's treatment of the Palestinians is based on subjugation, subordination, and so on. It's based on subjecting Palestinian sovereignty to essentially a solution that's mediated with Israel. And Israel has made it very clear that any context of that will only arise if its security can be guaranteed. And that obviously means surveillance, control, limiting the aspirations of any Palestinian state at all. So it would be absurd. And as you say, it is like the South African policy under the white government to create these so-called homelands, these Bantustans, where on paper they look independent, but of course they're utterly subordinate to the particular dominant regime of the day. And it is almost a cruel joke to talk about the notion of a two-state solution in the current circumstances.
And is it true that there was a close connection between the white South African leadership and Israel many years ago?
Oh, yes. There's been a close working relationship that took place during, because the Israel was has been over the years actually establishing links with many states of whatever stripe. You know, this is the other thing. It should be noted. And certainly was providing assistance to South Africa. South Africa, of course, subjected to its sanctions and so forth, to a set of sanctions, and also being isolated as a pariah state. There was an Israeli connection in the context of the supplying of military equipment, ongoing cooperation, and so on. And if I'm not mistaken, also in the context of the secret nuclear program that was being undertaken, because let's not forget that the South African apartheid regime did actually develop nuclear weapons and destroyed them before Nelson Mandela came to power. So this is something to keep in mind. So a lot of these things were being done in secret and being conducted in that way. And you know, as Anthony Lowenstein has done so admirably and comprehensively in his book, Palestinian Observatory, just looking at the idea of Israel using the people of Gaza as essentially a laboratory for the use of weapons, which they can then literally, you know, export to the world. To all sorts of regimes, authoritarian, semi-authoritarian, liberal, democratic, whatever you might call them.
And we can't ignore that the role of the US in the build-up of Israel to what it is today.
Oh, the US, of course, is the primary sponsor, the arch defender. That there is this fundamental domestic agenda that keeps the US so unhealthily tied to the Israeli military-industrial complex. It's a strange union in the States that links, for example, evangelicals and, you know, Christers and born-agains and all that, because they anticipate, like others, you know, of the millenarian school of thinking, that there will be a final reckoning in Israel. And for that reason, Israel needs to be protected. And for that reason, Israel must be sponsored and so on. Of course, we can always easily forget the fact that these so-called evangelicals in the States who are so happily backing Israel will, at the end of the day, expect the Jews to convert to Christianity, or else they will not go to the promised land, so to speak. But it is a huge problem. The United States, of course, has been conspicuously absent from these statements being made, and has, of course, expressed its objection to any move that might suggest pushing the Palestinian statehood in the absence of Israel's approval. It is by far the stumbling block. If the United States could be convinced, or if policies of the US would turn cold towards Netanyahu and towards Israel, generally speaking, then you would probably start to see tangible things on the ground. And in fact, it's very clear that things can be done, that the Israelis will listen to the United States under pressure. History has shown that. History showed that in 1956, when Israel participated in one of its first adventurous moves, with, of course, colluding with the British and the French in the Suez Crisis. And the Eisenhower administration was very, very stern about Israel's involvement in this. So, you know, things can be done. It's very clear. Economic measures can be undertaken. Social measures can be undertaken, as has happened before, to influence the course of conduct.
Well, as you've noted, it's not just the governments of the Western countries, including Australia, who are supporting the state of Israel. It's the millionaires and the billionaires, particularly in the United States. But there's a fair few here who are contributing greatly to the state of Israel. And I believe that the Jewish communities in those countries are encouraged to keep Israel going and also send troops to fight against the Palestinians.
Well, yes, this is obviously an ongoing system of sponsorship and encouragement that has been going on for decades, and it's been in the works for decades. So the communities, and Australia is, of course, no exception. The Jewish communities here, and also the participation of the citizens who are Jewish, you know, then participate in the IDF. You know, they have stints in Australia, no exception. In fact, Australian soldiers, Australian Jews have served in the IDF. In fact, some of them have paid with their lives as fighting for the IDF. you know, in Gaza. So it's this is an ongoing thing, and the pressure that is and the mindfulness, I suppose, of any statement made that could be construed as attacking Israeli policy. And we know that in the context of Australia has its own ridiculously named envoy, targeting anti-Semitism here, keeping an eye on any statements that could be construed as anti-Semitic, you know, on the pretext of silencing dissent and the pretext of preventing constructive criticism about the Israeli policy. So we see that here very much in evidence, and as the Sigal report is a case in point.
Are there other countries, similar countries, setting up an envoy like we have?
Well, I know actually it's modeled on something similarly done in the United States, because the United States is very much into the business of having envoys dealing with this. It does, and had for some time, quite a notable figure called Samantha Power, who was also an envoy dealing with these matters. So it is one of those things that is done, but it's no surprise that in the US this is a big thing. But of course, the moment you start doing this, then you start actually, I would argue, inflaming a situation. You start drawing attention to something that's simply not there, and you start agitating in circumstances that create more disturbance than otherwise needs to be dealt with. So that's the huge problem with these kind of positions, if you like.
I'd like you to talk, if you would, Benoit, about a recent posting on Pearls and Irritations, which actually was first posted on Panapunch. And that was the documentary by Louis Theroux, who was in the West Bank. Could you talk about that documentary?
Yes, absolutely. Well, the thing with Louis Theroux is that he is a famous British documentary maker who likes investigating the kooky and the curious and the peculiar and the downright weird, as he likes to put them himself. And he made a very recent trip to make a documentary about what's happening in the West Bank. And he, in doing so, he was revisiting a part of the world that he had done so about a decade prior to that. So he was quite, and usually he's very deadpan about these sorts of things. He doesn't tend to engage in a very, you know, overtly political way or agitate in a particular way. He tries to be as fair as possible, as balanced as possible, and so on. He's certainly not polemical. That's something you can't accuse him of. But even he struggled to maintain that kind of veneer in the context of the interviews he was conducting. You know, one of the he had, for example, actual physical scuffles with a few. There was an Israeli guard who came up and tried to sort of, remove the cameras, put the cameras away, and so on. And in the process, there was he was accosted, and Theroux actually said, "Don't touch me." And also the instance about dealing with some of the key figures of the settler movement, who are very, very dogmatic and firebrand types, who are very keen to see Gaza leveled. And in fact, a few of them are very much part of the settler Gaza movement. They are the ones who actually argue that Israel should never have pulled the settlements out of Gaza and should still be there, and are waiting for the time that the Palestinians will be evicted. So they're waiting, essentially, in deep enthusiasm for the prospect of ethnic cleansing of the Strip. So Theroux went through this and went through spending time with certain individuals. One of his Palestinian guides, for example, was treated abominably. He also goes to a home where, of a Palestinian home, where they end up being pursued by, you know, by Israelis, you know, full armored with night sights and night vision and so on, being harassed. And so it's quite an extraordinary situation. And to see essentially the structure of segregation and apartheid being portrayed in that manner is quite astonishing. So, you know, and Theroux is quite, it is a really chilling documentary in that sense, because the people he does interview, you can see they're permanently armed, they're permanently engaged in their mission, if you like, and they do not see the Palestinians as human in any sense, and it's quite chilling.
Are you saying that some of these settlers in the West Bank now were kicked out of Gaza many years ago? Is that what you're saying?
Well, because it was part of an Israeli withdrawal. It was part of the idea, and this is where Hamas then took over, because Israel made a unilateral withdrawal from Gaza, and this was around the same time that Hamas then took control. The idea then being that Hamas would be the divisive counterpoint to the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. So yes, there were settlements there, but they were then forcibly removed, as in those settlers were removed. But the policy, and those are the people, certainly that through interview, these are people who are very much of the view that they want to see the conclusion of this conflict so that they can return or bring, and in fact, bring settler families into Gaza again. So that movement used to be seen in parts of Israeli society as a bit fringe, you know, the individuals there participating, say, West Bank, and even though they're supported now more than ever by the Israeli state, they used to be seen as fringe dwellers, more or less, in terms of that ideology. But now they've moved to center stage because of people like the very pro-settler individuals like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, you know, who are very vocal members of the Netanyahu cabinet. So that's the other thing that Theroux does demonstrate, so the normalizing, I suppose, of rather extreme attitudes that has taken place and how seemingly fine it is. It's quite remarkable.
Well, when you're talking about normalizing, the stories that have coming out of Gaza and have been coming out less in other months, but now seem to be on the ABC and SBS, of the absolute cruelty of the soldiers who are in Gaza, killing and maiming without remorse at all, of can be babies, children, just going into tents and just killing people, sheltering in a tent, blowing up schools, hospitals. It seems to be, well, I don't know. I don't know how you'd explain it, that they can convince those soldiers that it is their right of might to just go into another place and destroy what they like.
Well, yes, there is certainly a sense that they are operating with impunity. They are operating with a mission in mind. They have decided that they do not feel confined by or restrained by international law and conventions and so on. And they are operating exactly like that. They are operating in a, you know, with a ruthlessness and with a hatred, you know, which is very clear. It's very clear that these are many of these individuals who are participating. They're starting to rein in these things a bit more, but there's a lot of social media coverage that they're very happy to post, many of the Israeli soldiers, about what they've done, the ecstasy about blowing up a school. Or there's not much to blow up left, by the way, so they're running out of options. But there's certainly a rich array, a grotesquely rich array, should I say, of postings on a series of online platforms that demonstrate the glee of destroying infrastructure, civilian lives, and so on in Gaza. So they have been programmed to do this too, it should be said. Now, they are, you know, their mission is to essentially wipe out as much as they can any Palestinian resistance. And of course, the notion of distinguishing, you know, between, you know, Hamas and Palestinian population is a nonsense. It's simply not being done.
Just finally, Binoy, where does this leave the UN, set up in the late 1940s after World War II, never again? What's going to happen to the UN, and where does that leave the Palestinian people?
Well, the UN, I know it's strange enough, but the UN may be one of the only last voices of or avenues of sanity in the whole business, even though it does get a bad press and bad rap for, you know, its incompetence and some sickness, supposedly its lack of effectualness, you know. But we do have the International Court of Justice, which is a very important aspect of that international governance. It has issued, you know, three provisional order measures that Israel deal with the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Yes, it's true, it's not being observed, but it's still there as an important beacon. We've got, of course, the admirable work of Francesca Albanese, who is the rapporteur, looking at the Palestinian territories and human rights violations there in the context of that, you know, who's very much, who in fact has done such admirable work that she is warranted, she's agitated or irritated the United States to a degree that she's now received sanctions from the Trump administration for doing so. But she has done some sterling work demonstrating the economy of genocide, if you like, as she puts it, you know, and how it's operating in the Israeli context vis-a-vis the Palestinians. So there are still important things. It is a body, you know, with its various branches that is still very important. But unfortunately, it is only as important ultimately and effective as the nation states that make it up. And unfortunately, with the UN Security Council, the way it's structured, with its veto powers, countries are always going to sort of be expressing their national interests or their self-interest and not necessarily follow human rights. And that's always been the problem. But for all its problems, it's there, and I'm glad it's there for all its imperfections, because a world without the UN, I would say, will be even more dark than it is now.
But it'd be much better without that veto power.
Yeah, well, this has been a long debate, this veto power, as to whether it should be there or not and how it should be exercised. But it is a relic of the aftermath of the Second World War that the permanent five have this veto power. But it is, and by virtue of that, it means that especially human rights does tend to suffer when it comes to measures, precisely because the founding five can actually exercise a veto to do that. But this has been a long debate about how to reform that particular aspect. But unfortunately, that's something that we have to live with at the moment.
I thank you, Bunawi.
Yeah, anytime, Jan. Take care.
And I've been speaking with Dr. Binoy Campmark, Senior Lecturer in the School of Global, Urban and Social Studies, teaching within the Bachelor of Social Science, Legal and Dispute Studies program. A little of Binoy's background. Binoy's research and teaching interests lie in the intersections of law, international relations and history. Much of his research and teaching involves the examination of conflict, diplomacy, and the various crises confronting international society, including refugees, terrorism, so-called rogue states, and undocumented citizens. Binoy has written extensively in both refereed journals and more popular media on his research interest topics of the institution of law, diplomacy, international relations, 20th century history and law. The quality of his research has been acknowledged in awards made by the US-based International Association for the Study of Forced Migration and Limina, Journal of the History Department of the University of Western Australia.
The Victorian state government is planning repressive new laws to restrict protest, including bans on protective masks and lock-on devices, increased police search powers, restrictions on symbols of resistance such as flags, and creation of so-called safe zones around religious buildings, putting significant areas of the CBD off limits. We must say no to this attack on democracy. Protest is a fundamental human right. Join the fight to defend it at a mass rally hosted by Defend Dissent Coalition on Tuesday, 12th of August, 5:30 p.m. at Parliament House. Defend Dissent Coalition is a 3CR supporter.
Next, the final part of the webinar, examining the influence of the Zionist lobby in Australian politics and media. It featured Ahmed Alabadla from Gaza and involved with the Palestine Justice Movement, a grassroots and democratic Sydney-based collective organising for justice for Palestine. Also, Wendy Bacon, investigative journalist, Australian academic and political activist, who was awarded the highest Australian journalism prize, the Walkley, in 1984, for her articles about police corruption in New South Wales. Yaakov Aran is new to journalism, having come from a background of activism. Yaakov brings unique perspectives to the Palestinian struggle. Credited to his political journey away from the ultra-Orthodox Jewish and pro-Israel education of his youth. His research concerns the Israel lobby, Jewish community, party politics, and the arms trade. This segment begins with Ahmed Alabadla.
I'm keen to address the other incident that has always also made a big fuss in weaponizing anti-Semitism, the caravan that was full of explosives. So I really want to, if you could briefly describe the caravan false flag incident, and within that context, how is it best to describe or talk about these incidents without sounding, you know, conspiracy theorists?
So what happened with the Tour Caravan was that there was in early January, after a wave of different attacks against the Jewish community centers, a few cases of arson, a few cases of graffiti, different other things, there was a climax where a caravan was dumped on the side of the road in the outskirts of Sydney. It had a pretty large amount of bombs from, you know, mines, really outdated explosives. There was no detonator there. It was dumped on the side of the road for several days. Then some person, for some reason, thought, hey, why don't I tow this caravan over to my place, because it's just kind of hanging on a corner and someone might, you know, bump it. And then several days after that, the person found, they peeked into the caravan, their driveway, which wasn't theirs, and they could see a number of explosives. They called the police to deal with it. The police say that they found a note with the addresses of a central synagogue, some anti-Semitic comments on the side. I mean, speaking as a writer, if I was doing a criminal cop story, a detective story, and there was a caravan full of explosives with the address of the target and a comment saying, you know, something like kill all Jews, fuck the Jews, I would say that is really poor writing. It is very on the nose. It's a real dead giveaway. It's really clumsy criminal conspiracy. And I mean, the people who were later found to have bought this caravan and owned it and dumped it there put comments on, you know, community Facebook groups, hey, just got a whole lot of money, looking to buy a caravan. Or like, hey, does anyone know where I can find a few gallons of gasoline? Public community groups that anyone could dig up on Facebook to this day. Not your brightest criminals. And then police had, and the government, the state and federal government, were clearly on different pages, putting out some very different narratives, constantly changing the narratives, clearly not coordinating with each other. What they were coordinating on, however, was legislation to push through to ban any sort of protest that is close to a place of worship. Now, what this means is that you cannot have a pro-Palestine protest or any protest near a place of worship. So you cannot protest for Palestine if it's potentially near a church of Scientology.
Without even arriving at any conclusion at the back of the back of this incident.
It was largely pushed through because of this and was modeled on different laws that were actually put in place to protect abortion clinics from pro-life protesters. So this is the way that Zionism, which is a fascist movement as it stands today, lobbies for change, especially in Australia, through these fake liberal values, tending to be for diversity, for social cohesion, for multiculturalism, supporting religious minorities, supporting women's rights to abortion. But no, Zionism, in the way it advocates its agenda in Australia, is never about more civil liberties. If you ask a Zionist what makes Jews safer, they'll remind you of the Nazis and the Holocaust, but they'll never say, well, the Nazis were very authoritarian and fascist. We should make Jews safer by having more civil liberties, more freedom, less of a police presence, less security cameras. No, it's always a bigger crackdown on dissent. So the law that was amended, specifically Labor, we know that they refused to create clauses that say the protest has to be related to that place of worship. So you cannot have a protest for taxing billionaires if it is close to a mosque. How close does it have to be? How far does it have to be? Again, Labour refused to say that. The Great Synagogue, which was allegedly the target of the Dural caravan, they wrote to the New South Wales Anti-Semitism Inquiry with a submission, and they strongly condemned Labour for refusing to say how far the protest needs to be. They said it must be 500 metres. That's our recommendation, which pretty much rules out any protest anywhere in the central business district of Sydney. And it's actually interesting that even before that, a month before the caravan was found, these laws were first kind of mentioned and pushed forward the day after Fear Birrenbaugh from the Cairo Takeaway stunt pulled a separate stunt where there was a protest outside the Central Synagogue, the Great Synagogue in Sydney. And he happened to be walking past to a ticketed event at the synagogue, and he happened to have an Israeli flag, and he happened to have his spy glasses on. He stood across the road after filming them secretly, getting their faces, and then taking out the Israeli flag and causing a scene. The next day, the media says, well, you know, it's not safe for Jews in the Sydney.
In fact, he was on Sky News. Yeah, in fact,
yeah.
I mean, again, the incident happens, and next thing, he's on Sky being interviewed, calling for a crackdown on protests. So it's really hard not to think that, just going back to the caravan incident, that as Yaakov has explained, that Four Quarters did a program about it and interviewed a criminal who said that he was trying to negotiate the ability to come back to Australia. He was on the run. That was not satisfactory. It left a lot of questions unanswered for the audience. But what we can see is the political agenda behind the caravan incident. Of course, it caused fear for Jewish people in the Jewish community. I mean, it would, but that's not the point, because it was clearly serving a political agenda.
Just quickly, I mean, with the Fear Birrenbaum incident in December, it was literally 9 a.m. the next day, Chris Minns, the Premier of New South Wales, came out with this policy. It's not something, some sort of policy you come up with on the fly. It is something that they saw an opportunity where they can make this palatable and they can sell it to the Australian public. This criminal mastermind allegedly behind the caravan, the guy who was pulling all the strings, after lies and lies and lies by the New South Wales police, the federal police, the New South Wales government, the federal government, they're finally now saying, well, this time we're telling the truth. We have found out that the criminal mastermind is an Australian criminal who's fled to Turkey on major drug trafficking charges, right? He was giving police information, the federal police, that then they weren't passing on to the New South Wales police for whatever reason, but that they knew that this guy was pulling some strings, had a lot of insider information, and that he was doing this to create what's called a plea bargain. You know, if you give inside information on other crimes, you help police with certain things, then you can get a lighter sentence. And I mean, I don't know what sort of criminal mastermind would think that orchestrating fake terrorist plots against the Jewish community is going to get them a lighter sentence, drug trafficking charges. If that is true, certainly not a mastermind.
And now Chris Minns is being challenged, I think, for these new laws that he enacted by Palestine Action Group. I think there's a legal case.
I mean, could I just interrupt for 1 minute? I don't want to hold you up, but I've just was checking something. The two people who were taken into custody for the social media posts, they're not pursuing those charges with them. They're out of prison now, but they were involved in another incident, but they weren't involved with the caravan incident. So that just adds further suspicion.
I do want to take the conversation to the universities and the influence of the Israel lobby on universities. So the question is the AUJS involvement in the university section. So how connected is the AUJS to the Israel lobby? What is it acronym for, Australian Union?
AUJS, the Australasian Union of Jewish Students.
Yeah, the Australasian Union of Jewish Students, how connected is it to the Israel lobby, and how do they work?
This is the equivalent of Young Labour and Young Liberals for the Israel lobby. If you're a good senior figure, a good operator within AUJUS, then you have a very easy segue into Labour or Liberal Party politics. Like Michael Dandy, I believe he was national political president in the 80s. Josh Burns too. Dean Scher, an advisor to Albanese and to Josh Burns and to Dandy as well. I was a former UNSW president of AUJUS a long time ago, and I had different political opinions. I remember that there was a very clear policy time where if anyone faces some sort of abuse, and even if they are unsure that that abuse was anti-Semitic in nature, the policy is that they report it to the university and to AUJUS, that they pass over the handling of that abuse and that complaint to AUJUS, and that will be reported as anti-Semitic. That is a policy in writing, documented, reported on by Honi Swa in an article early last year. The AUJUS actually, they had a panel in, I believe it was 2022, with the national chairperson and a few other people, together with Gillian Siegel, who at that time was the president of the Executive Council of Australian Jewry, the peak roof body in the country. Gillian Siegel's already talking about a lot of the things that she's doing now, having the universities adopt the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism or something like it. And it's a very controversial definition because it conflates Zionism with Judaism. She was talking about creating a student ombudsman role for handling anti-Semitism that is very closely imitating what the sexual violence student ombudsman. The far right actually gets something very correct. Andrew Breitbart, who founded Breitbart.com, the far right newspaper, he's got a famous quote where he said, Andrew Breitbart said that politics is downstream from culture. And a lot of that begins with universities. So, you know, you see what Trump is doing, what the far right are doing anywhere in the world. It always begins with going after, you know, what they call woke politics, politics on campus. And it's actually a very effective strategy.
Well, I think Yakov has explained the connection between the Jewish Students Organization and the Zionist lobby. It's obviously the recruiting, very closely linked. We're very involved in the Stand With Israel movement as well last year. But I just did want to say something about universities and why it's not at all surprising that it's a key site for contest in this situation. Universities have traditionally been, I mean, you would expect that. Here's people who are, even if the universities don't deliver very satisfactorily, it is a place where people are meant to be thinking about ideas. So if you go back to the 1960s anti-Vietnam War movement, I mean, there were major occupations throughout the Western world anyway, like in throughout Europe, in the UK, massive actions. People were shot at Kent State in 1970 for protesting, shot by the army. And then during the Iraq war, also war in Iraq, there was also protest. So I'm not surprised. In fact, I think it would have been really surprising if there hadn't been any actions on campuses. I think it's very disturbing the way the universities have set out to crush this. That we've got unprecedented oppression of academics and students. I mean, the whole thought that you now can't, you know, I can't always believe it, you can't go and put up a placard or you can't organise a protest. I talked to a student at UNSW who had been potentially going to be suspended because she organised a meeting. Like, this is a major intrusion on civil liberties, and people should be mobilising against it and standing up against it, alumni as well as students and staff. So, yeah, it doesn't surprise me, but there's many disturbing aspects to people who have been punished.
Ask my last question, and this is a big question, about the media. A lot of the TV reports, they're nauseatingly full of clips of Netanyahu and IDF and then the Israeli narrative. and they rarely reports that are reflecting the Palestinian narrative. They bring the Palestinian narrative, but they heavily and strongly challenge it, while they don't even touch on any of the Israeli narrative. One can't stop wondering, how did our media get so homogenized that way? I mean, how did we get there? You know, people now are waking up to the reality of the Palestinian struggle, and they feel that they've been sleeping over these years and decades. Like, how did we get here?
Well, I mean, I don't know that we were ever in a very different place. If you went back to the 1990s, there was an extraordinary level of Islamophobia, particularly, of course, in News Corp, but it was throughout the media, you know, and I think part of Islamophobia is not only the hate, but also the silencing, as if whole communities are not there. So in some ways, I don't feel surprised. Like, we're always, as an academic, we're always trying to get people from different backgrounds, non-Anglo, non-European backgrounds, into the media. That's been a huge fight over the years, including with the ABC. And that's why it's so dismaying to see people like Antoinette Latouf, Jan Fran, who I think is in the ABC, but is playing a very critical and good role, I think, and Noor Hager, who were young people from the Western suburbs who saw that they could enter journalism and then to be sort of pushed to the margins of the ABC. And Noor Hager said a very important thing about that. She said that she has really lived experience of domestic violence in her family. Her father tragically killed her mother in Sydney. And she's always been able to, in a sense, not in a cynical way, don't say this, but she's always acknowledged she's been able to use that experience to do better journalism. When it came to her Lebanese background, which included her grandmother being shot with nil accountability by the IDF, that was not counted in the ABC. That, in fact, was a disadvantage in the ABC, to the point when she did not want to be there anymore. That's all last year. But this week, I found it just, you know, I watched the 7:30 report last night, and I know exactly what you're talking about. It's like we're hearing the American-Israeli perspective. Yes, a couple of questions are getting asked, but we're not seeing what's still happening in Gaza. And I think many of us have got to the point when you watch it to kind of know what they're doing, but you watch it in the most critical way. And I think more, you know, it's not the media for the people who live in the communities in Western Sydney. It's just not their media. I guess I'm not so shocked, but I'm not so shocked, but I am appalled. I'm appalled that in 2025, this is the state of the Australian media. And it's absolutely, and in a way, I think the ABC does track to the, always has tracked to the government line when it comes to foreign policy.
Yes, like especially the ABC. I mean, I could understand it if it comes from Channel 9 or Sky News. I mean, these are kind of, you know, more conservative, far right. But the ABC, like, publicly funded, and, you know,
BBC has been pretty bad as well. Jonathan Cook, who's a very good journalist who used to be at The Guardian but had to leave for similar reasons there, he has been hugely critical of the BBC, which I think may have improved a little bit, has improved in recent weeks. But I think the ABC has got worse. You've got very experienced correspondents like John Highfield who say that it is just more controlled from the top now.
Why do you think it's got worse?
Because I think overall the independence of the ABC has been undermined. I mean, I know it sounds like I'm contradicting myself here, but yes, the Islamophobia has always been there, but there was more of a spirit of independence at the ABC. When I say independence, I mean journalists collectively organising to push back when management tried to interfere.
There was a very interesting story that John Highfield, a former ABC presenter, was very high profile back in the day, where he was talking about the Sabra and Shatila massacre mid-2000s when Ariel Sharon, the Prime Minister of Israel, was then at the top. And he provided some background on who Ariel Sharon is, that there are some serious allegations that he was partaking, that he had a very high level of responsibility for the Sabra and Shatila massacre, where hundreds, perhaps maybe even a thousand, several thousand Palestinians were massacred by Christian Lebanese militia that were let in to do the job by Ariel Sharon's IDF troops that he was commanding on the ground on that day, that he knew very clearly that they had come into that town, Sabra and Shatila, to do massacres, and that he knew that they were doing the massacres as it was happening. He continued to let it happen. So the Israelis founded the Khan Commission to look into it, and they found that he was actually responsible, and he stepped down from the Israeli cabinet position at the time. I believe it was the Ministry of Defense. You know, this is from the horse's mouth. This isn't John Highfield editorializing, giving his opinion. He's literally quoting what the Israeli government inquiry into Ariel Sharon found. When Ariel Sharon became prime minister, I mean, this is a very important context. You tell people, the audience who might not know who Ariel Sharon is, this is who he is, this is his background. There are some serious allegations of war crimes. Unfortunately, the next moment, as soon as that program was over, he got called into the ABC office, the management's office, and they said to him, "What are you doing? You're not allowed to say that." And there was perhaps, you know, some sort of very aggressive phone call from a lobbyist telling them to pull the plug on that program. And he said, "Well, you know, it's not my opinion." He presented them with a translation of the Khan Commission inquiry by the Israeli government. And they said to him, "Well, you know what? Your translation of that must be incorrect." This is how it's so homogenized, because...
Can I just say, Yaakov, nothing happened to John. Like, he just stood his ground and he said, "I have the evidence here." And so he was using it as an example to show how things have changed. Journalists are much more compliant now. And I think that another really strong example this week of where what Yaakov is talking about is a backgrounding. Like, when you're a journalist, if you're naming a significant figure and there's some good background information, just succinctly, that you can pop in there. Now, this week I've been watching, like, Israel has nuclear weapons. It's a very relevant fact in this current situation to know that Israel has a nuclear arsenal. And
that they developed illegally, and that they haven't signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Why is this mentioned journalistically? Why is this silence?
It's in context,
misleading.
Yeah.
It's misleading the audience, I think, about the broader context. And I've got
to say, go so far as to say it's a lie by omission.
Yeah. Yes, a lie by omission.
By omission.
Now, I've got to say, as a journalist, you know, I've got a lot of sympathy for journalists. I know it can be tough when you're under pressure and, you know, you have to sort of negotiate your way, as you do in many jobs, probably academic jobs too. And when all this began after October 2023, you know, there was some protests outside the ABC, and I was invited to go and speak. And I've got to say that I was in two minds, you know, as to whether I should. Well, I guess because I was a journalist, but I don't have those feelings anymore. I've really moved to think it's most important to state the truth about it. And it's important for journalists to do that too. And after all, we haven't heard about the, you know, hundreds of journalists who have been killed in Gaza. That is also played down by the media.
More than 250. Yes. Something I wanted to pick up on, something you said, Wendy, last time, that story in the ABC, the video interview of Nasser al-Mashni that was taken out. So it just gets me wondering, like, how does this influence of, you know, the Israel lobby, like, is ABC self-censoring from the inside?
Yeah, I think it gets into the head of journalists. So they're sort of self-censoring. And a really good example of this was when the presenter of I think I might have mentioned this last time, RM Breakfast, was interviewing Gillian Siegel. And she, even the ABC acknowledged this, failed to ask appropriate questions when she was saying extremely questionable things. Now, that's all been, again, you know, excused, it was a difficult situation and whatever. Because, as you know, anybody knows, people want to survive in their jobs. They want to prosper. They want to be promoted. They don't want to be on the redundancy list. as people have found themselves this week. You know, I think you learn to, you fit into the environment and you become more compliant. But there are young journalists who've told me, so people have gone in the last 10 years, that they find it almost intolerable. And for some of them, it is just a matter, some have left, others, it's just a matter of how long they think in their conscience they can survive there. So it's a pretty grim situation unless, and obviously ABC management is restructuring again. There's got to be incompetence there. And this has been a long project to make the ABC more compliant, not just in relation to Israel, but on other issues as well.
So just to build on what Wendy had said, I mean, what's really phenomenal about just the way that the Israel lobby always seems to provide a unified front and that the media presents them as a unified front, not just as representatives of Israel, but also as representatives of, you know, the Australian Jewish community at large, and as, you know, all being fundamentally on the same page. I mean, you would not know if you only pay attention to Australian media that in the past couple of weeks, we have two former Israeli prime ministers, Ehud Barak and Ehud Olmert, as well as Yair Golan, a senior leader of an Israeli opposition party, saying that Israel is committing apartheid, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and ethnic cleansing. You would not know that if you paid attention to what the Israel lobby is saying here and what the Jewish community group is saying here. You would not know. In fact, if you did say it, you would be accused of anti-Semitism, plausibly, in Australia. You cannot say what the Khan Commission inquiry into Ariel Sharon being responsible for war crimes says, because that is anti-Semitic, it's alleged. There's this very strong taboo in the Jewish community and, you know, the Zionist advocacy spaces at large as well, of what they call airing dirty laundry. If it's bad for Israel to be aired publicly, you do not say that. And of course, this is only ever used by people to the right to push down people a little bit to the left of them, even if they are all Zionists. You never hear people who are presenting themselves as liberal Zionists saying to the fascist Zionists, hey, why don't you just pipe down a little bit on your request for quicker, faster, more brutal genocide? That's not good for us. No, that never happens. And in fact, if you did say that, that would be airing dirty laundry. But if they say to a liberal Zionist, the fascist that is, you know, why are you constantly talking about the need for Israel to be both Jewish and democratic? Like, we can't live together with the Arabs. You shouldn't be talking about these things. You shouldn't be talking about two-state solution. It's, you know, it's bad for Israel. It's airing our dirty laundry. Now, that fascist Zionist will generally win that argument, will win over the audience if that debate is happening in the public space of the Jewish community.
I want to take that thread and talk about the stuff that happened in Zionized, if I may use the term, Jewish schools here in New South Wales or in Australia. There's this question about the Zionist schools promoting anti-Arab, anti-kind of Muslim kind of speeches and rhetoric. Is that, to what extent is that true?
I mean, to a great deal. Growing up in my school, we would pray every morning for about an hour. Once a week, we'd bring out the Torah. Sorry, twice a week. We would say a blessing for the IDF and for the state of Israel, and a third blessing for the Queen of England as the leader of our country. This was very, very much ingrained into our culture. It's baked in. This isn't just the case for my school. It's the case for most of the Orthodox or ultra-Orthodox synagogues across Australia too. So, you know, we had, you could say, like a mini little synagogue within our school. I remember we would have Israeli soldiers, veterans come over and give us talks about how it's the most heroic thing you can do. You have schools like Lebel Yavne College in Melbourne, which brags about on its webpage how many of them have flown over to join the IDF. They have a massive plaque for every single one of the alumni that has gone on to join the IDF. They have a big mural to former Israeli prime minister and leader of the terrorist group Irgun, that's Menachem Begin, a massive mural to him in the college. This indoctrination starts young. It continues with Zionist youth groups that meet on the weekends. These youth groups and the schools have all sorts of programs to send the kids over to Israel at 16 years old, 18 years old. A lot of those legs of those trips to Israel, to things like when I was 16 years old, I was taken to an Israeli recruitment center for the IDF, IDF museums, to accommodation centers for lone soldiers. I was taken to munitions factories going back to the Nakba, which were literally under children's playgrounds in a kibbutz near the south of Israel, near the town of Rehovot. I mean, these things are all over the place.
Promoting Israel rather than promoting any sentiment that is anti-Arab or anti... So to me, it doesn't sound like a big deal. Like
in many ways, the Arabs, they weren't even thought about. It wasn't part of our consciousness. There were hordes of savages outside of Israel who were anti-Semitic, who wanted to destroy us. There was no understanding of the Palestinians. I learned what the Nakba was. I learned the word. I was like 20 years old. I didn't know that there were people living there before who were kicked out. And I was already involved with the Israel lobby before that. I've already held jobs in the Israel lobby. And I knew, you could say, a fair bit from a very close-minded perspective, but a fair bit about the situation happening there. I didn't even know what the Nakba was. We were not taught to think about the Palestinians. Their existence is raised from the conversation. It is about supporting Israel. It is about fighting anti-Semites. It is about Israel's fight is our fight. The Palestinians are not given a second thought.
It's really interesting because I met so many Jewish people who are anti-Zionist, and most of them are elderly, like in their 60s and 70s, and they always tell us how they found out about Zionism, and they kind of were resurrected out of this racist ideology late in their age, like in their 40s and 50s. But now we're seeing hundreds, if not thousands, of younger generations waking up to these kind of realities in their 20s and their, you know, in their teenage time. So the tide's shifting, or the tide is turning. Times are changing, and I think that's a great, great change to the positive for the Jewish community, for the Palestinians, because this ideology is really plaguing that faith, and you know, this rogue state, genocidal state, behaves in a way and in that genocidal way, and claims to speak on behalf of the Jewish communities around the world.
You have been listening to the final part of a two-part webinar looking at the role of the Zionist lobby in Australian politics and media. And that was Ahmed Alabadla, who's formerly from Gaza and now working with the Palestine Justice Movement, and also Wendy Bacon, long-time investigative journalist, Australian academic and political activist, and Yaakov Aron, formerly an activist, now working in journalism.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast. Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.